Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, from September 2, 2017. This is the second of a series of talks and Sangha discussion on karma and rebirth. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So this is the second of who knows how many talks on karma and rebirth. We got about 15% through the article. So just to go what we started with, karma is the continuity of dukkha within impermanence. That's a pretty clear statement, right? It's just the ongoing experience of Well, but that also points to the other three noble truths and the cause of it. Karma is the present unfolding of past intentional acts moderated by present mindfulness. Everybody understands that, at least to a certain extent. What we hold in mind is really what determines our experience. It's not just the momentum of our past intentional actions. It's what we're holding in mind, the present quality of our mind.
It confuses me because at one point I read that in the book that your first book that but karma is impersonal. So if it is related to us through our actions, then how I get confused by the impersonality of life.
Yeah, great question. Thank you, Eva. The unfolding of karma is completely impersonal in the sense that it's not something happening to us from an outside force. It's simply the present moment unfolding of our past intentional actions. And that isn't, even though we're experiencing it as me, the action of karma means action. The action of that unfolding is completely impersonal. There's nothing directed at you. It's just it is just what's occurring. But it's what's occurring as a result of our past intentional actions. But it's not, and I was thinking about this on the way down here, because that can be a little confusing, I think. We're here today, right now. What we're experiencing right now is an aspect of karma. But it's not something that we should be taking, it's not blame or consequence. It's simply the result of a decision that we made. In this case, it's a relatively benign decision to get out of bed and come here. But how we're experiencing it, let's say that you didn't take kindly to the fact that the teacher got up and walked out in the middle of meditation. That's making something that is impersonal personal. And you could see how that could easily change the way you might hold that resentment even when I get back here. And so you're not going to listen much to what I have to say. I'm making somewhat of a silly analogy, but no, you can see how that would play out. Then you would be taking something that was entirely impersonal, me walking out of the room, mm-hmm. as personal.
So I'm going more with the interpersonal thing. If I were to have tripped you when you came back, then that would then have been an action that would have created the possible future action of you wanting to trip me in return.
Sure.
So that becomes a personal.
That's beautiful. That's karma playing out. So there's always a choice too. You can choose to trip the guy or not. You can choose to react in a way that is unskillful to what's occurring, and you will create, you will put in motion. You will take an action, karma means action. You will put in motion a series of events, and those series of events aren't predetermined, but they're the result of that one action you took. That's karma unfolding. Or we could choose to practice restraint, and then we're not contributing to the momentum of karma anymore.
So I guess, again, it's always a matter of what we think a word means, because when I look at personal...
Yes.
You know, I think of interrelational, so that if that creates that action or that possibility of an action, then I still shouldn't take it as personal.
Yeah, because if even at that point, even after you tripped me or tripped the guy, there's an opportunity to stop taking it personally and realize the unskillfulness of your actions. And it's at that point, no matter how far down the road it is, it's whatever point we recognize the reaction in our mind that's causing more karma, more unpleasant experiences, at whatever point we do that and stop it, abandon it, as a Buddha would put it, we cease creating additional karma. That's so that statement that karma is the present unfolding of past intentional actions moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. Whatever we're holding in mind in this moment will determine how that past intentional actions unfold in the future. If our minds are well concentrated and well framed by the Eightfold Path, we'll cease creating any more unskillful opportunities for disappointment to arise in the future, and that leads to rebirth, what we're giving birth to in the next moment, not a future life, which is what's most important. Thank you for helping clarify that point. That's so important. Does that make sense to everyone?
Yes.
That really is. I mean, that's karma. So we're done. We're done with that. Saved a lot of
record. Everything comes down to how you think, hold, or act upon any past or present action.
Yes. In thought, word, and deed, that our lives and our awakening play out in our thoughts, our words, and our deeds. But if you think about what Eva brought up, we can only take something personal in our thoughts, can we? I mean, there's nothing physical about, I mean, if somebody smacks you, you take it, but your reaction is you have control of that. You have control of how you take anything, how you frame anything. And if you frame it within the framework of the Eightfold Path, you won't take it personally, because even if it's a personal attack, you'll understand where that person's coming from their own ignorance. And if it's a worldly causes and conditions, if you get caught up in something horrible like what's happened in Texas, you won't take that personally, because you'll understand that's simply an aspect of living in the world. It's arbitrary. It's not personal.
So why me is probably the worst question.
Take half of that. Why is the one question that will keep us in ignorance. I think I told a story last week about my friend, the Jesuit brother, who... He had 7 nervous breakdowns, and I know you can't, you're not supposed to use that word anymore, but that's still. And we used to have these great talks, and he would always finish these talks by saying, never ask why. He says, if you really want to box yourself into a corner, which is what he did over and over again, keep asking that question why. Because even the Buddhist teachings on dependent origination say we can't know. We don't know where this came from, where we're going, or any of those, or why something happened to us. The only thing the only control that we have over anything is the way we react or respond. Jen.
Wow. So something Lorna said last week kind of gave me like a little sort of abridged idea of what karma is, and it's working so far, so I'm going to hold on to it.
You're going to cling to it.
Is that it's karma is the interplay of the three marks of existence. If they're kind of bouncing off of each other, then that's karma. And if they're not, then there's no karma. So stress or the events of the world, dukkha, occur, and that stuff that happens highlights or brings to light impermanence or anicca, and then the self or anatta will react to the concept of impermanence and start to try to maintain itself. So if that's happening, then that's karma. And if it's not happening, it's not karma. And if you can stop it somewhere along the line, then you're on your way.
Yes, that's it. And that's it. That, Bhikkhuni Lorna was absolutely correct in that. Yeah, the last thing that I was going to say is just that. No. Karma is the personal experience of three marks of existence.
So maybe you said it, and then she highlighted it.
She explained it very well. That, in that sense, you could say karma is the whole Dhamma. It's about recognizing it. And this is what I was just thinking as Jen was talking. This is really remarkable, the discussions that we're having on this, because karma in rebirth is one of the most misunderstood teachings, and it's often just dismissed as something that is completely unnecessary, when understanding karma and rebirth is understanding the whole path to awakening, isn't it? That relates to that great saying in the Vitakasanthana Sutta: we gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, because of, and most importantly, so we can recognize and change the direction of our karma. That's the path to awakening. It really is. We should stop right here. It's remarkable what's developed.
There's no doctrine of reincarnation in Buddhism.
In modern Buddhism, it's mostly based on that. And the Buddha referenced it, but referenced it in such a way to downplay any real importance to it. And I believe he referenced it only because it was so well entrenched in the spiritual doctrines of his day, too. In other words, it can't be avoided. I wouldn't even reference it in that way, except to explain that future rebirths are completely unimportant, except to understand that if you don't figure it out now, you're just going to keep creating the same thing, or it's going to be Groundhog Day.
I view rebirth as different from reincarnation.
It is.
You know, like if your parents were abusers and then you raise your children in an abusive way, that's a rebirth of that situation.
Yep.
But coming back as a bird in the next life, I view as reincarnation.
you're absolutely right. But there are some doctrines that would have you come back as a bird that abuses your chickies, you know, because of that. And none of it is really. The big difference between what the Buddha taught and the common teachings of reincarnation of the Buddha's time is that the soul is not, an individual soul is not the same entity that goes from life to life to life. And this is where it gets a little tricky, because we have a hard time relating, well, then what is it? And it's simply an ignorant view. And this is really the easiest way to explain that, but I don't want to go too far with this, it's not that important. It's only an ignorant view that is reborn even in the physical sense. There's no self attached to it. It's not, in other words, I die completely ignorant. John Haspel with another name but the same person is not going to be reborn at some point in the future, subject to the same sins that I committed. You know, I'm going to talk more about this when we get a little bit deeper into it. But just to quickly clarify, just like from this moment to the next moment, whatever I'm holding in mind is going to determine the experience. But the same physical body from one moment to the next moment is not the same. So it's really the disappearance, the discontinuity of a physical body and the reappearance of a physical body through a longer length of time. That's the only difference. And of course, you get into the physical parts of you know, physical rebirth, being born. But that's essentially what takes place from one moment to the next. We just don't notice it because it happens too quick. If we had the ability to have an incredibly well-focused mind, we would be able to notice a difference between this physical body, this moment, and the next. But if we did, we wouldn't be able to live in the world. It would be too hyper-focused. We wouldn't be able to live moment by moment. So it's more of a protective measure that we don't actually notice birth, death, and rebirth with each passing cell, each dying off cell.
And I think that's why kind of the Buddha would not answer when people ask those type of questions, such as, you know, what happens after I die, because that's not really the point of what he's teaching, and it just makes it so much more, you know, easier to follow and understand and not, you know, just deal with this next moment and not this next lifetime.
Yeah, Buddha wouldn't try to answer, but I just tried to, didn't I? And I don't know how helpful it was, but we'll touch on rebirth and the important thing about rebirth is what we're giving birth to right now in our lives. Who cares what's going to happen a million years from now? Because I have control of what's occurring right now. I got to go back to the one paragraph that we finished last week with. Whatever one continues to pursue with their thinking becomes the inclination of their awareness. Being mindful of right intention and abandoning thinking imbued with craving, clinging, and sensuality inclines the mind towards release. Those are the Buddha's words. He's telling us how to deal with karma, how to deal with our life unfolding. My words. All the events of life are not the result of individual karma. Most of what occurs in one's life is simply worldly conditions and described in the First Noble Truth and summarized as there is stress, there is dukkha. Simply what's going to occur as a consequence of having a human life. And that points directly to taking things in an impersonal way. An awakened human being say there's gonna be, he said there's going to be struggles in life. Life is going to be disappointing and unsatisfactory at times. And it has nothing to do with you as an individual. Reaction to impersonal events will create additional karma and further conditions, an already conditioned mind. Reaction arises from wrong views of self, getting back to that, the three marks of existence. It is wrong views that initiate and proliferate karma. Once all wrong views of self are abandoned, the establishment of further karma ends. When there's no more self-referential ego self in the world that you're defending and protecting and hoping to continue, that's the cessation of karma. It's also, again, you can see the circularity of this. It's the ending of karma. It's the awakening. It's the ending of anatta. It's the ending of the struggle of the three marks of existence. It's the ending of ignorance. It's all the same thing. It's all awakening. As with all the Buddha's original teachings, karma is taught in the context of Four Noble Truths with the goal of the cessation of suffering. In this context, karma describes the ongoing suffering rooted in ignorance and reinforced by wrong views and wrong intention. The Buddha's words, karma should be understood correctly. The cause of karma should be understood. The diversity of the results of karma should be understood, meaning the diversity of results means look at all the different things that can happen. It's not just one thing. It's an infinite number of manifestations of karma that can occur. And that creates even more confusion, doesn't it? We really start losing our minds over what is happening to me? What's going on? And there's times when the world seems overwhelmed, doesn't it? I mean, we've all had that experience. That's karma. Seeing things clearly, there's nothing to be overwhelmed over, but it happens a lot. And it seems like it's happening more and more, but worldly causes and conditions.
No, I was just saying he's turning up the energy of things.
Yeah.
You know, like the speed of technology today, I think, is turning up the energy of a lot of people.
Oh, I agree. And our engagement with it. We don't have to, but it's an aspect of worldly causes and conditions that we get caught up in all the different technologies, thinking that we need to be always plugged in. You know, always, and another word for being plugged in is clinging. Always clinging to the world.
Yeah.
You know, and look at one of the great recommendations of the Buddha is to find seclusion in your life. That also pertains to this. We don't have to always be plugged in. We don't always have to have our cell phone and, you know, all that stuff going on. But that is an aspect of karma unfolding too. The causes and conditions of the world that we engage with, it's our choice to engage in it. So it's our choice, it's our action that we're taking that is causing that additional stress in our lives and everybody's life today. Great point, Anthony. Thank you. Karma should be understood. The diversity of the results of karma should be understood. Cessation of karma should be understood. Of course, if we're going to bring it to an end, we should understand how to do it, right? The Buddha's pointing to the Eightfold Path here. And he concludes this by saying, the path developing the cessation of karma should be understood. It's the whole point of the Dhamma. And again, when we start diminishing or dismissing the importance of the Eightfold Path, what we're saying is, I want to continue my ignorance. I want my karma to continue. I don't want to have any control over my awakening. I want to ignore that which would deliver me from that. My words. Notice that these are the same words the Buddha used to describe the truth of suffering, karma unfolding. Whether experienced as pleasure or pain is an aspect of dukkha and originates in craving and clinging. So often, and even in our conversations, we're tending to qualify karma as something that is always negative, and it's not. Karma is also getting that nice new piece, nice fresh piece of chocolate cake, isn't it? Especially when I'm reacting to it, especially when I'm clinging to it. Or another, you know, anything beneficial that I take personal, my good fortune, my good luck, is contributing to karma. Because what happens, you know, as I'm saying this, I'm thinking of those, I don't know why it fascinates me, but it still does. The people that win the lottery, they win tens of millions of dollars, and a few years later, they're dead broke again. And I don't know if it's some kind of morbid way of looking at it or what, but it is fascinating, isn't it? That somebody who might have been living on $50,000 a year all of a sudden has to live on $2 or $3 million a year. It's just not enough. It's never enough. We cannot satisfy a self-referential ego self. We'd all like to think that we'd act differently, and some people do. Not everybody blows the lottery.
I think
but
it's almost like the need to be back to where you were before, because having all that
there's changes, your identity. Yeah.
Changes everything that you were, and so it's more comfortable to just go back to what you were.
I think I think that's probably it. You know, what we're not, we don't have an identity yet of being a zillionaire, you know, so we don't know what to do with it in a practical way. The Buddha continues, intention is karma. The second factor of the Eightfold Path, right intention. Right intention is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. What would continue karma is continued craving and clinging. With intention, one does karma through thought, word, and deed. What Helen just said. And what is the cause that initiates karma? Contact. Now, remember how we've been talking about dependent origination and that part of, I think it's the sixth factor of dependent origination, the sixth link in the chain? This again relates to dependent origination and the importance of unraveling the links of dependent origination. The ongoing process of ignorance resulting in confusion and suffering can be brought to an end through wisdom and ensuing right actions framed by the Eightfold Path. So karma means action. The action that we take to engage with the Eightfold Path is the most important action we can take. The Buddha continues, and what is the cessation of karma? From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of karma. And how does one experience the cessation of contact? Through the Noble Eightfold Path. So again, this has to be taken in the context of Four Noble Truths. The Buddha is not saying completely cut yourself off from the world and don't taste anything or look at anything or smell anything or touch anything. Practice restraint at the point of contact. And if we can practice restraint, then we're no longer contributing to additional karma. We're no longer contributing to additional confusion, deluded thinking, and disappointing experiences. At the point of contact, as reaction arises, practice restraint. And sometimes we have to do it post-reaction. In other words, we recognize that we've already reacted to something, maybe in a very unskillful way. But all is not lost, because it is at that point that we can recognize the unskillful action, take a breath, take a step back, and that will allow us to learn and to reinforce that that's something we won't do, we don't want to do again. And again, this isn't really from a moral, ethical standpoint. It's from an entirely practical standpoint, so that I can awaken. So I can stop contributing to my own confusion, delusion, and suffering. So I can stop contributing to my karma. It's clear, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just a little bit more, and then we'll break for next week. So this shows that the driving force to continue confusion and suffering is described by the Buddha as karma. This is to point out the importance of being mindful of all thoughts, words, and deeds. This is a purpose of mindfulness in the context of Four Noble Truths. It is your actions that will determine your awakening or continued confusion and suffering. The framework for recognizing, understanding, and refining your actions is the Eightfold Path. Through wholehearted engagement with the Eightfold Path, you are taking actions that directly influence the unfolding of your karma and incline your karma towards developing a life of lasting peace and happiness. So we're going to stop there. That's about 30% through, so we'll probably be four classes on this. Maybe more. The discussion is just wonderful. Do you all see how this really is... Karma is really the unfolding of the Dhamma also. It's not just the unfolding of dukkha.
Yeah.
And how we look at it. So we're starting to learn that karma isn't bad. It's not good. It's completely impersonal. If we happen to be someone who's having the most incredible life, we shouldn't look at that as good karma, because that's just as much of a trap as having a difficult life and saying, "Oh, I just got bad karma." They're both false, and they both just continue ignorance. To recognize that what is occurring in this moment is karma, and it's my choice how that's going to affect the next moment and the future moments of my life, depending on how I respond or react. Eva.
So then, as Lorna and Jen are saying, then ultimately the goal of once you have reached enlightenment, then there is no karma, either good or bad. Because the whole point is to get rid of all karma.
Yes. And the reason why is that you will cease living life from wrong views, from self-referential views. There's no more I-making. There's no more karma.
Even though the Buddha reached enlightenment, he still had a life, only that he was not creating karma of any kind.
Yep, And that relates, some people, and there's some traditions that say once you awaken, you just completely vanish. And of course, the guy that figured this out, he spent 45 years. He didn't vanish. But he lived free of creating additional karma in his life. It doesn't mean that he didn't have difficulties. There's even the Buddha's last days were awful. He died of food poisoning, and it's described. He had terrible physical pain and all the other things that go along with it. But he didn't react to it. He simply understood that, this is a consequence. In fact, he told Ananda, there's the last one of these days I'll get to teach the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, but it's a sutta that takes place over the last 3 months of the Buddha's life, so it's going to take us a while to get through it. In that, he describes, in a very overall sense, the difficulties of having a human life but not reacting to it. So again, here's this belies the myth that an awakened human being just lives continually in this blissful state. It's only blissful because you're not creating more suffering for yourself, but as a practical way, you're living in the world and you're still subject to sickness, aging, and death. You just don't react to it anymore. And that's what contributes to karma. Good question. So, any other questions on this, and then we'll go around the room?
I think I'm missing something. If karma is the unfolding actions, maybe you can say better than me, but the your past actions unfolding in your present moment and how you're reacting to them, how does that ever disappear? It seems like that's just
reaction.
Your reaction can be skillful or non-skillful.
Yep. Thank you for the question. It's a great question. The disturbance in our mind ends because we're no longer reacting from a view of rooted in ignorance.
Okay.
So the momentum of our past acts. The momentum of our past act ceases at that point because there's nothing to push up against. Even look at it from a physics standpoint. If there's nothing to cause resistance to the energy that's moving, the energy continues indefinitely, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And if there's no resistance to what's occurring in our life, there's no consequence to it.
Okay. So it's the resistance or the reaction that gives a body to karma, so to speak.
Yeah.
If you don't react or respond to it, sort of like in Harry Potter, that who was it that an evil form. Help me out here.
Voldemort.
Voldemort. needed to have all these other things in order for him to have a physical body. So if we do not give a physical body to this Voldemort-like karma,
yeah,
it can no longer exist.
Yep, that's a great metaphor. There's nothing there for it to manifest. It's simply not.
Welcome to our family.
I didn't hear what you said.
Screen in my head. Always uses a movie
or a book.
Well, that's the next karma, the movie.
you know what's funny? You mentioned
a TV show about karma.
What's the movie with Bill Murray?
Groundhog Day.
Uh-huh. Well, and the gentleman who directed it, I forget his name, but he's part of that group of guys.
Yeah, I can almost think of his name. But.
Yeah.
Harold
Ramis.
Right, thank you. Anyway, he was influenced by his parents' Buddhism.
Oh, yeah.
By writing that movie.
Oh,
so
okay.
Every day, so because you'll see in the beginning of the movie, he's just enjoying, right? He totally like is destructive because he's enjoying that he knows there's no consequence or anything. And then he's trying to get over on the thing by learning things about the girl, right?
Yeah.
But then eventually he becomes virtuous.
Maybe we're gonna have to have movie night here.
That would be great.
Yeah.
We got the retreat. We should.
That's an idea for Saturday night.
Right.
Well, I'll see if we can do that. That'd be great. I know they have projectors and stuff. Lorna, you had your hand up.
I did, and people make such wonderful comments, and this is kind of like going down a negative road, but I get when I like moment overload, that thinking about dementia origination karma, and it's all in the moment, the next moment, I get moment overload.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Too much present moment.
I kind of understand karma in a talk, but then when I try to overlap it with other things and becoming, and you know, I get, and then I lose my learning because I lose a thought of what it is, solid thought of what it is.
Yeah, I know I'm the one that's making all these different connections and contributing to that confusion, I think. Always look at karma as just that simple explanation. That's the present unfolding of past actions, past intentional actions, moderated by whatever present level of mindfulness I have. That's really the important thing. The other, you know, the teachings, how it relates to dependent origination, it's best to look at even that kind of separately. And to look at dependent, even when we think of dependent origination, we shouldn't try to remember all 12 causative links.
Yeah.
Just to remember that it's ignorance of Four Noble Truths that causes confusion, delusion, and suffering. Because that points you in the right direction. What do I need to do with that ignorance? Develop understanding. What do I need to know about karma? If I'm confused or disappointed with what's occurring in my life, or even the way that I'm looking at my life, that's karma. What do you need to do? What do you need to know about that? Develop the Eightfold Path. Then it really is that simple. If you find that your life is less than satisfying, this is dukkha. If you find that your life is less than satisfying in any way, develop the Eightfold Path. Why? Because then it will become an ongoing series. Your life will play out in a satisfactory way. You won't need it to be any, another way of saying that is you won't need it to be any different than it is. Another way of saying that, when you cease needing your life to be different than what's occurring, you'll cease creating additional karma. You'll cease creating additional dukkha in your life. So thank you for that. Did I help clarify it for you?
Yeah.
It's a repetition, too. I mean,
yeah.
You know, it's just a matter of, I reread the book again, you know, your first book, just because I never got past it the first time. The whole comma, but now I understand it better, and I think it's only because of, you know,
yeah. Small things.
Yeah. Well, it is. It the if you take any one of the big ideas, dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, and take any one of them and look at them within the proper context that they're presented, of course you have to understand the context, they're pretty simple. But when we our minds tend to jumble these things together. We cling them together too readily. And that's when it becomes confusion. But that's a good strategy for a self-referential ego self to continue its own ignorance, to create confusion where there, it really doesn't need to be. The Dhamma, even though it seems so challenging at times, is really very simple. And it really does come down to Four Noble Truths, and that really comes down to the Eightfold Path. So why didn't the Buddha give those just those teachings, just continually give the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta over and over and over again? Because he needed to relate it to what was occurring in the world and to the people that he was teaching. And even this teaching on karma, it could have been presented in a different way, except he needed it to relate to the common usage of karma of his time, which was often presented as karma is punishment or karma is reward. And the Buddha, of course, he realized it's neither one of those things. Karma just is. It's just the present unfolding of past intentional actions, moderated by the present level of our mindfulness. So even that, I guess, could be a confusing statement until you get real. Just look at the last line. I need to take care of what I think. I need to be mindful of it.
Past intentional actions, unintentional actions.
They'll have no imprint. I mean, that really is true. They'll have no imprint on our in a physical way on our brain. Things that we don't carry with us, we don't carry with us. They won't have any impact in a real practical way. So there's millions of things that happen to you that you didn't react to in any intentional way. It's just part of life unfolding. It's what you reacted to that creates an imprint, a real physical imprint on our brains that creates a conditioned response, conditioned thinking, that leads to karma. And it's entirely practical in that way too. So I started out by saying there's such a thing as worldly causes and conditions. And worldly causes and conditions are things that just happen to everyone. It's described in the first, when the Buddha describes dukkha. It's also things like flooding and wars and all these types of things that none of us are directly responsible for. But how we react or respond to them, that's what we are. So you could have been, I know I have a friend of mine that was in New Orleans during Katrina. And she still goes into a panic just hearing about the next hurricane coming. Because, and again, she shouldn't not do that. It'd be crazy to say, well, you shouldn't feel like that. That's how she feels. That's her conditioned response. You know, we probably have dogs. Some dogs, they don't like the sound of thunder. They go crazy. That's their conditioned response. And my dog, for some reason, he loves thunder. Not everybody's karma is the same. In other words, just you and your sisters grew up in the same situation, but I bet there's situations that you have different reactions to, even though it's the same. Another example, Anthony would know this. Look, he's looking around. Five people can look at a car accident and there's five different stories. We experience things differently. But as far as worldly causes and conditions, that only contributes to our karma if we react to it. You know, and that really points to the subtlety of understanding. The Buddha describes an awakened human being as understanding suffering. That's awakened right view. We understand that simply as a consequence of having a human life, there's going to be disappointing experiences. It's only in self-referential ego self that says, I shouldn't have disappointing. Everybody else can have unsatisfactory life, not me. And the Buddha says, no, if you got a life, you're going to have some disappointment in it. And sometimes it's extreme suffering. But it only the intention behind it, to get a long way back to what does that mean, intention. An intention is something that is driven by craving and clinging. Wanting something to be different than it is, or holding on to something that has occurred. That's intention. That's what creates karma. If we eliminate craving and clinging, again, we're awakened. We eliminate karma. So, why, what a great discussion. Yeah. Anthony, how are you this morning?
Good morning. Just hearing this was making me think about when I was watching the news last night for the people that were devastated by the floods from Harvey in Texas, how some of them are living in such compromised situations and still finding the strength and the resilience to move on. I saw a guy that was half submerged playing a piano.
That's great.
And then a woman, you know, that was living in the back of a trailer, but she was thankful for that, and it made me realize that the news are they're picking people who are dealing with their karma very well, and they're not getting down about a bad situation. And I think it goes so hand in hand with modern psychology to develop strength and resilience and coping skills. It's just another way of getting over potentially bad karma. It's all kind of tied in together. You know, even this cognitive notion of reframing situations. So it's interesting that the Buddha tapped into something so important so long ago.
And like what Helen was talking about too, it has an actual physical effect on our brains. You know, and we know it. I mean, somehow the Buddha understood it back then, but we can prove it scientifically now.
You know, and I think the other really good thing is the compassion practice and gratitude, because that helps you overcome potentially bad karma too.
Oh yeah, and there's a lot of many practical experiences of that we're hearing about, like with Harvey, of people that have lost their own houses, yet they're out trying to help other people rather than, you know, talk about taking a reframing something in a positive way. What can you do for others? You know, there's and it's all part of that selflessness. Thank you.
It's going within.
Jen, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I feel like I have nothing to add except that I've been so distracted that I feel like I was even distracted in the class. Like when you started talking about people who win the lottery, I went on like a 3 or 4 minute like fantasy in my head what I would do if I won the lottery. You know?
And you didn't end up being poor in 3 or 4 minutes.
Exactly.
You gave some to your friend. I'm sorry, I'm going.
Jen, I started with foundation.
I'm going on that trail with you.
I just, but it is nice to, you know, like when I wake up in the morning, I feel like everybody in here has said they have experienced this. So you go through periods where you're very, very distracted, and then periods where you have a lot of clarity. But, you know, I feel like ego wakes up in the morning before awareness does. Five or six
gets a head start on the day.
Of like conditioned like thought processes happening when I wake up, and then I like my awareness comes in and is like, what is all this? What are you going on about? Like, and it's nice to have that, even though I've been distracted. It's nice to have that kind of those moments of awareness where I'm able to say, you know, just breathe. This is not, none of this is relevant. And just kind of not get bent out of shape about it. And I feel like, you know, karma, that kind of points to just the day-to-day bringing in of karma, or bringing in the idea of karma, of just being, saying, seeing where the clinging and craving is. If you can see through your day, you know, that you're thinking about something other than what you're doing, which is probably all the time, you're bringing in a little bit of awareness.
That's a good argument for that first sit early in the day, isn't it? Because you start reframing the way you're looking at the world, you know, rooted in concentration. Thank you. Mary, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here. I'm sorry I'm late. I was
Right. Were you? I didn't notice it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It was the weirdest thing to walk into the room. It took me probably like 5 or more minutes to come up with a zillion scenarios. He's not feeling well. Maybe he's not here today.
Not that I was practicing invisibility at the moment.
No, I just had all this concern.
Claude Rains effect.
And then I said to myself, you were just allowing his not being here to distract you. And so I had to get focused. But I was like, wow, we're not children. We can do this without you. But anyway, I had a week of a lot of distraction, and it, and I'm still not through it. It's taken a lot of discipline and coming back to my breath to try and have certain things that happened this week not affect me personally. I mean, I'm just so conditioned for that. And I don't have to be, but I'm working through it. So the practice has come in handy. But like when other people talk about being able to, and you've talked in suttas about things that cut away that thing that you need to let go, I have a dull life. I mean, that's so hard for me. And so I really... And I will tell you, I started a few emails to you, and I should have engaged in conversation, but I was so distracted that I didn't take advantage of that. But I'm working through it. I just, like from a long time ago, there's certain things I take so personally, and it's just really hard to cut that.
Yeah, it is.
Let it go, because it's. I can say to myself, I can look in the mirror and say, it's not me. It's not who I am. It's impermanent. You know, it's like yada yada yada.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah. When we've created a strong identity by clinging,
mm-hmm.
you can speak to yourself till you're blue in the face,
yes.
as they say, and it,
yep.
it won't. It really. But it's the beginning of the process to recognize that. That's so
mm-hmm.
important.
Oh, I long chat with my husband. He's like, "What is it? You know, like." Really? Right? You're still holding on to this? You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with him, but, you know, he was, like, speaking to me very intelligently. I was like, I know. Yep, you're right. I know.
Well, when you're ready, please send me the email.
Thank you.
Mike, good to see you.
John, good to see you. Very grateful to be here. So, you know, speaking about reacting to events... I come from a different place. Accumulation over the years, I have shut down. I have no reaction. I see what happened in Houston on the news, and it's like I saw the score of the baseball game last night. And it's not because I'm an insensitive person, but there's just been so much over time that I have literally no reaction.
Yeah.
So, you know, a friend of mine mentioned to me about, you know, the Nazis in Virginia, and woman got run over, killed by a car. And I said, this is the extent of how involved I get. I said, that's awful, that's horrible. The Nazis are about the most evil people you can imagine. And over the past dozen years, we've dropped an average of 3 bombs an hour on other countries. And I'm like, you know, I can't react to things that are happening now because I think of, in a broader context, really sorry for bringing everybody down here with this, I'm sure, but I've just shut down. And again, it's not because I'm not a caring person. And I have, you know, a teenage daughter who I need to have conversations about when things like this happen. But in terms of things unfolding, how does that play in? You know, when you shut down? Because, I mean, it's kind of like, yeah, I'm not reacting to things. You know, I'm not
yep.
setting anything bad in motion. But shutting down isn't a good thing either.
Shutting down is your conditioned reaction to what's occurring. And a lot of people have adopted that strategy. It seems reasonable, you know, doesn't it? You know, there's just so much going on. It doesn't not contribute to karma. It's simply your strategy to continue to ignore. Remember, ignore the assumptions that you've made about life, dependent origination. You can't get away from it by creating a strategy of non-reaction. It has to be an honest non-reaction rooted in reality. Yeah, so the Ratana Sutta is probably the best example of this. The Ratana Sutta is the sutta where the Buddha teaches the three refuges of taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And the Ratana Sutta, that sermon, was given to a town that was overcome by floods and disease, a time of incredible suffering, human suffering. The Buddha's response, wise and awakened response, was first to attend to the physical needs of the people. He spent a few days, him and the 500 monks and nuns, first took care of the people that were suffering. He didn't just say, "Man, suffering's beyond me. Listen to what I have to say." He took care of their physical needs, and then he taught them the Dhamma. And he taught them the Dhamma so that they wouldn't, in a way, to show them that this is probably going to happen again in your life. There's going to be awful things. This is the proper response, to see things clearly. So you won't react. You won't contribute to your own suffering. So getting back to that, your conditioned response, while it seems is not reactive, is your reaction to it. But it's a common strategy too.
It's not intentional though.
Oh no,
it's totally reactive.
Right, yeah.
It's just simply the condition that you've developed. You know, there's and again, we create all types of strategies in all different ways to address karma unfolding in our lives, or simply the living with the causes and conditions, because we don't see that clearly. You know, that's why we create these strategies. You know, they seem to work, but you're recognizing in yourself, and excuse me for using you as an example, but you're seeing that it's not a skillful response, is it?
Well, I mean, I if something were local that I could physically help out with something, if there was a flood in the river down here or whatever, people need help, I would be here to help.
Yeah.
I mean,
I know you would. I know
right,
you would.
And then, but still, it's I don't, you know, I never ask why. In terms of, you know, what you said earlier on, is why do these things happen? I don't. I'm just like, it just keeps happening. And,
yeah, that's...
And so, but I don't think, you know, my way of not asking why is necessarily skillful.
Yeah, well, you use the word. You're shut down. That's right. So that's something different. Again, it's good that you recognize your conditioned response to what's occurring in the world. Because the only reason it's skillful is because you're not really present with what's occurring. So being really present doesn't mean that we have to be wailing at what's going on, overreacting to it, but to feel what's appropriate. You know, so it's appropriate. When I hear about Harvey, I don't say, well, I'm going to get on my meditation cushion so I don't have to even think about it. It's painful to think about what's going on, but it's an appropriate painfulness. I understand that it's a consequence of living in the world. Some of the spoken responses are really ridiculous, and they get into almost blaming the people for what they're experiencing. And this has happened before. The most egregious example, I don't know why it happened there, was when the tsunami hit Japan a couple of years ago. And a lot of people said, well, it's their karma because of what they did in World War II.
Those aren't even the same people.
Yeah, I mean, but people have made that comment in some ways about there's some kind of... People believe that there's some kind of lack of spirituality, and I don't know, it doesn't make sense. But that's why Texas got hit. That's why Houston got hit. Houston got hit because on this planet we have floods. That's
right.
You know, that's why. That's the only reason. There's nobody to blame. Yeah, they blamed that on people's sexual choices, didn't they? What?
Well,
it's ignorance. It is ignorance.
Right.
Think about that. But it's convenient
it's like
to use
other things in life that people have been ignorant about. But
yep.
Yeah, it's convenient to just say it's.
Yeah, to qualify your point of view by using a pop term that people don't even understand. Oh, that's karma. That's why it's happening to them,
right.
And that gives it validity.
I think it's also a conditioned way to divorce themselves from the pain.
Yeah.
Because I think that's racism at its basis. Fear.
Oh, yeah. It is, of course it is.
Yeah, you can say that this terrible thing happened to those people
you don't have
that are different from me, and I'm doing this other thing to maintain my purity and health that is not what they're doing.
Yeah.
Right.
And you put a convenient label like karma. But that's really what, that was more or less the common usage of it even during the Buddha's time. And as you can see, the word could, like I said before, the Buddha could have changed the word from karma to something else. But he used the word karma because it was commonly used to describe what was happening in a person's life, but from a wrong view. The Buddha used the same term to bring right view to that commonly used word. But you can see it's still used in that, more like it was in an unskillful way during the Buddha's time today. It's, I mean, even as a pop term, it's always used as, you know, like a dark cloud, or you're gaining something because of something wonderful, because you're such a wonderful person, you deserve this. But Mark, good to see you. Always good to see you. Good to have you back.
Always phenomenal discussions that happen here.
Yeah.
That I get to listen to online sometimes too. Mm-hmm. So thank you all for that. Appreciate it. I don't know that I have anything to add. Everything has been so wonderful that everyone has said, and it's always helps to bring so much clarity. So
yeah.
My practice is going well. Path and be gentle with myself when I don't. So,
one
thing that Mike said that I'll mention because it brought it to mind for me is that I found that I used to do, still do sometimes, the same exact thing. Just shut down. And when Mike brought that up, it reminded me of the retreat that I was on. The situation was that my brother-in-law was attacked, and this was a couple years ago, and my wife was really very upset about it, and I couldn't get upset. I like just shut down, no reaction. I couldn't get upset. I wanted to get upset. I just couldn't find myself being able to do it. And at the retreat, I got that clarity to understand that I was afraid of being upset. I was afraid of having the emotion, and part of it was that I didn't understand that it was okay to have an emotion about it. But that was just, and John, you kind of helped me with that a lot. So it was just being alive, living your life, to feel an emotion towards the situation that happened, and not a reaction. There's nothing I could do. I couldn't go back and change it that he was attacked. I couldn't be there and stop it from happening. So instead of accepting that, I reacted by shutting down and not having any emotion about it. But once I was able to recognize that fear is what was preventing me from having the emotion, suddenly the emotion flooded up, broke out into tears, crying, and it felt incredible, as odd as that might sound.
Because it's appropriate.
Yeah.
I remember the talk we had on retreat, that, and it's such a good example of that. You know, that it's really put on men in our Western civilization, but I think even it's beginning to be increasingly put on women too, that you shouldn't show what you're feeling, and that's the opposite. It almost sounds I'm contradicting myself, that we shouldn't react, but we should react. When we develop the Dhamma, we always respond in an appropriate way. And when that appropriateness is sadness over a brother-in-law getting beat up, it is. It's simply appropriate. But it doesn't have to lead to anything. We don't have to, oftentimes a feeling like that, just feeling the sadness or the grief, will then lead to, I need to strike back at the person that caused, you know, and that's the reaction to it.
But that's the subtle difference that I wasn't.
Yeah.
That I think relates back maybe to the conversation we're having today, is that I saw having an emotion as having a reaction.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of having an emotion being the reality of what I'm feeling.
Yeah, and it's really just feeling what's appropriate in the moment, you know, and that when we've taken the I making out of that, we don't even have to consider, is this feeling appropriate? It will be appropriate. because it's not a reaction. It's simply part of living in the world. And when sadness is appropriate, it's simply sadness. When joy is appropriate, it's simply joy. We don't have to have more or less of it. We don't have to judge it or anyway. We don't have to shut down as a strategy to avoid the reaction to it. It's simply life as life occurs. It's really the great understanding, and it's probably the great misunderstanding. How many people think that this we're talking about annihilation and you shouldn't have any feelings at all? You should have all the feelings that we get to have as being human beings, but we have them when they're appropriate, not when they're inappropriate, not when they're unskillful, and lead to more confusion.
That's the moment that became clear for me.
Yeah. So,
thank you,
Mike. Thank you for being here, and I'm glad you're coming on our retreat.
Can I add one thing?
Please.
What everything that you guys just were talking about, because when Mike said that, it struck me too as just the same experience, and Mark, the same experience of just repressing. And
yep.
This practice has helped to. I have become, I would say, not more emotional, but more expressive.
Yeah.
Emotionally expressive, and just to say that it's not only what Mark was saying, how it feels great for me personally, but what another thing that I recognize is that it improves my interaction with others.
Absolutely.
Because if I am expressing an appropriate reaction, or I'm sorry, an appropriate emotion. If I'm expressing an appropriate emotion, that's not reacting. I was used to think it was reacting. And that is helping other people be in right view.
Absolutely, yeah. From your appropriate mindfulness and appropriate actions that follow. Sure, that's how it works. Think of, that's exactly how the Buddha taught. Was from that appropriate mindfulness. Thank you. Helen, good to see you this morning.
Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Fabulous class.
Yeah, I agree.
Great to see new faces and old friends. I have a lot of good things coming into my life right now, which is bringing my life back into balance.
Mm.
One thing that I know I have a tendency to do is be more okay than I actually am. Sometimes I have other things going on that, I have that, you got to get up, you got to keep, one foot in front of the other, and you just keep on going, and you find what's good around you, but there's still this other stuff in there. And so I'm having more good things come into my life and tip the scale in a nice way, and I'm able to look in and see the things that I'm still carrying. Not willfully, but they're still there, and I'm able to release more things. Part of how I've maintained some sense of order in my day and in my life is recording times and dates and moments. It's the work I do, there's a certain element of time, like how long it takes something to do. Is how much you get paid and all of that. So monitoring time is part of what I have to do, and so there have been things that have happened in my life that there are dates attached to that I'd like to let go, and I'm starting to be able to release the memory and release the date, and then there are no anniversaries. So it's very freeing.
Yeah.
So a lot of good things are coming my way now, and it feels great. So my previous concerns about karma being all my fault, I no longer have that understanding, that belief.
Good.
I know that it's all about how I look at things, how I look inward, and how I look outward. And I'm in a good place.
Thank you. I'm glad you're in a good place. And the practical application of the Dhamma. That's such an important point to understand, that if you're having a tough day or a tough period in your life, it's not because you've done all kinds of things wrong and you're getting punished for it. That's just life occurring. But your reaction to that is what what is important, and you're having a balanced reaction. So life is pleasant. Thank you. Eva, good to see you.
Mm-hmm. Good to be here. I find that the most empowering thing that I've... Well, everything, a lot of what the Buddha says is empowering, but I like the idea of that I am the owner of my actions.
Yeah.
I'm the heir to them. And it just really... Dum-dum-lay-lays, you know, that makes all the sense in the world. It's so simple, it's so obvious, and it's such a responsibility, too. And I can see why we wouldn't want to be the owner of our actions and blame other people and, you know, say that it's others' fault when we really have to take the responsibility that I own my action and what happens after. And I'm very grateful to have it.
Thank you, and thank you for saying that. Can you see when you're blaming the world or other people for what's occurring in your life, that's a perfect strategy to continue ignorance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And being miserable and unhappy, and that's when you kind of then stop and say, oh, it happened because I just did this.
Yep.
Oh, wow, you know, I can't really blame anybody else. I can fix it by not taking the next step that, you know, would obviously create a negative thing, and that by not reacting to it at all, there is a vast openness of other opportunities that I didn't always see before.
Yeah. Thank you. Mary, good to see you. Liz, good to see you.
My father used to do that.
My mother has yet to call me. Well, she's passed now, but she never called me John. She'd go through the whole list of my brothers and sisters. But she never,
I think this is all so important. And what Lorna said a while ago about, recognizing things in the moment at that point, it sticks with you because... everything within the Eightfold Path is a solution to confusion, continued confusion,
yes,
and conflict in some cases. But it's all good. And who would have thought that the discussion of karma would take, you know, how many classes? 24 classes?
We'll see.
And how it's sort of, every time we have these discussions, it unfolds another layer.
Yeah.
But the layer always references back. It's like a Mobius strip, as Helen always says. It references back and it moves in and out and, disrupting the clinging aggregates and, you know, it's just all folds back into itself. And I love the idea of when you're in that moment of recognition of karma from a past situation, that it all goes back to ignorance of the Four Noble Truths.
Yeah.
And that you can just keep folding and playing and moving things back and forth and recognizing the moment and giving yourself forgiveness and treating yourself gently and then starting over again. And so, you know, it's just, I love the way that happens, the way it just keeps folding back on itself.
Yeah.
It's like wedging clay. It just keeps folding back on itself and stuff goes in and, you know, you just keep folding it over. So,
thank you for saying that, because it's a it points to how to understand these teachings. And if you can't make the connection back to the Four Noble Truths somehow, it's probably not a skillful presentation of any of these things. Karma and rebirth is a good, a real good example of how that it doesn't turn back towards the Four Noble Truths. It ends up at a point that doesn't have any relation to what the Buddha taught. And then it's not something that is really useful to follow. Because it all relates to awakening. The only thing the Buddha was concerned about was developing full human maturity through the Eightfold Path. So thank you. Mary, good to see you this morning.
Good to be here. Week's been going well. Last week I was in a pit, and the talk really, last week's talk on karma really pulled things together made me more skillful, and it definitely pays off. It makes me really feel sorry for people who have the poor piss on me. And I look at their lives, and that's why their lives are the way they are.
And
it's just amazing the way the Buddha put everything together so beautifully.
Yeah.
And it just makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, thank you for saying that too. That, and there's so many people that just, they walk around like that, like there's a dark cloud over their head, and they just don't have the good fortune to come across the Buddhist teachings. That's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And I don't think a day goes by when I don't recognize how fortunate I am to have come across these teachings and to be part of a sangha that is so well focused that we can have these great classes, class after class. It's really amazing. Thank you, Mary. Glad you're here this morning. Debbie, good to see you.
Well, I just want to express gratitude because I feel like this class has been great and I learned so much, and it's like there's so many teachers in the room.
Yeah.
Right? And I don't really have anything to add. I'm listening and learning and feeling that gratitude, and I just want to express that.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. Lorna, good to see you. Good morning.
Good morning. I really don't have much to say either. But these two talks, last week and this week, were really quite amazing. And really the understanding that's come out of the two sessions. Just to say that my meditation sessions at home have been really very quiet. My mind has been very quiet. Being able to hold my breath, my mind and my breath for many, many breaths. I hate to say this, to the point of it being boring. I can just sit and hold my attention on my breath.
Oh, nice.
I can't say that's followed off the cushion. I think I'm still quite confused in a lot of ways in my life. And I know you always come back to the basics. You can get a bit heady with all this Dharma stuff, and then come back to the basics. Just come back to your breath in the moment, and just settle everything down. So I thought this week that to be mindful and not try to let my imagination go in the moment. That if you could share your breath with the moment. Meaning, and I think the word share is a very sort of Dharma word that, sharing is a good emotion to have. It's a good basic thought to have through your life. And if you could share your breath with the moment, you're not disregarding the moment to come back to your breath, solely on your breath, and you're not disregarding your breath in the moment. There's a relationship between your breath and the moment and your breath, and just keep that relationship, just a soft relationship. And I thought that would be kind of a nice way to try to be mindful, and but also not exclude life, because you can't exclude life anyway. So you have to have a happy medium, 50-50 balance. Share your breath with the moment is a nice overarching thought.
That's beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. It really is. The Hawaiian word aloha means my breath in your face, but in a loving way, I'm sharing my breath with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. What an incredible class. It's 20 after 10. Please give me a little feedback on this. I try to think about completing a class by around 10 o'clock. Is this too long? I mean, the discussion was great. I wouldn't want to cut anybody off, but I also don't want anybody to think, you know, I can't go there because it goes on too long or anything like that. So if you do have to leave early, it's okay to get up and leave. But thank you all again for this incredible class. The retreat's coming up. If you're going, please sign up. It's going to be just like this, but an opportunity to spend 4 days. It really does make
and really good food.
And really outstanding food in a great place. But to be within the Dhamma for 4 days really does make a difference to our practice. This article that we're referencing is out of the new book, too, by the way, just so you know. If you're reading it, you might say, well, whatever. I'm referencing it, you know, and it's also the article that's online. So we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today. And these are the words of the Buddha on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace.
This was a very good one.
It was. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.